1968.
I was wondering what you can recall about the 1915 riots, for instance.
Yes, in May 1915, riots broke out in Ceylon. It's a Buddhist person's part in the Kandy.
Yes,
Buddhist person's part in the Kandy mosque. And they objected to the procession passing with music. And they demanded that the music should be stopped. The procession is reduced. And then some Muslims began to throw stones at the procession, which resulted in some people injured. And those who were taking part in the procession also retaliated. And then a Muslim from Akshaya building fired a shot, and one man died. This news reached, news spread like wildfire throughout the Canadian provinces, and there were riots. Single people began to attack the Muslims. Horrible injuries were caused. And then the news spread to Colombo and other places. And there were most of the important boutique shops belonging to Muslims were looted. And some were killed. Some were severely injured.
Were these only the Hambayas or the Cosmos?
Only the Cosmos. But then some of the Ceylon was also suffered injuries. They started the indiscriminate attack. Then what happened was, then martial law was proclaimed. While the riots were in progress, the police sued his folded arms, they did not, showed his attitude of martial inactivity. Then later on, after the holding had subsided, martial law was proclaimed, and then a period of terror commenced. So his military men went all over the island. They were shooting even at innocent women who were plowing their fields, harvesting their fields. And then large number of people were arrested. Men like leaders like Sir Baron Jayadeva, C.A. Hewaitharan, Edmund Hewaitharan, Pieta Thirukkan and others were all arrested and locked up. Then what happened was, D.E. Pages was charged. He was a military man and he was tried by court martial and he was charged. And a number of others also had to get sentenced for things first. I was a short attendant to the court martial judges.
That's in Colombo or outside Colombo?
Outside Colombo. Mm. These court martials were held at various places, like Veyangoda, Kandy, Kwanpur and other places. And I was their shorthand writer.
Before you were employed as a shorthand writer, were you working for the government?
No. Mm-hmm. I was attached to the Attorney General's Department. Then they wanted a shorthand, military people wanted a shorthand writer, and my services were lent to them. So I went there, and then what happened was, the trials were most perfunctory. They did not consider the evidence in the case. And on the perjured testimony of Moors and some Muslims, innocent people were convicted and they were sentenced to varying terms of imprisonment, like 20 years, 15 years penal servitude, and some were sentenced to be shot.
Was the evidence always bogus and perjury?
In almost 99% of the cases. What happened was, these military men were untrained in the art of sifting evidence. And they did not know how to analyze the evidence. Mm-hmm. And all the eminent counsel appeared and made very powerful speeches. Their attempts were useless. Mm-hmm. I rendered a small service in my humble way, because these military men told me, you need not worry about the... You can just take the evidence in chief briefly, and you need not worry about the cross-examination. So I made it a point to make a full note of the cross-examination, evidence in chief, cross-examination, re-examination, everything, because I knew that someday these proceedings will be scrutinized by somebody else. Mm-hmm.
Who were the military people who told you this? Can you recall their names?
There was one, Muscat Williams, another man, Colonel Jones, and each military court consisted of three judges, court martial.
No civilians at all?
No civilians. And they had a big volume called the Riot Act. That was a Bible. Then I wanted to do some service, with the result that So I decided to write down everything word you did, without omitting a single word. Then when Sir John Anderson came to Ceylon as governor, he sent for these proceedings and went through this evidence and found that these innocent people had been convicted. With the result that he went on discharging the prisoners one by one. Mm-hmm. Almost 100% of the prisoners who had been convicted during the riots were set free.
Did you personally witness any troubles in Colombo or outside Colombo?
Oh, yes. I saw most horrible acts being perpetrated. In fact, I saw most being killed. In Colombo? Yes.
Whereabouts?
In Dam Street, Beta, Fort Topsic and other places.
By whom?
By the Singhalese fighters. Singhalese mobs.
Were these thugs or were they just, did you find?
No, they were thugs also among them, but the ordinary people. They were in a fuel. Mm-hmm. They thought that their religious rights had been assailed by the moors.
Now, in the Tanadura, Gaul and areas and in Kanem provinces too, you got some killing and looting and...
Oh yes.
Now, there couldn't have been all that many thugs in that area, so that means that the village folk also...
Oh yes, village folk took part. Mm-hmm. Because they were roused by religious feeling. Mm-hmm. They thought that all sorts of vile rumors were spreading. In fact, there were stories to the effect that was cutting off the breast of Singhalese women and committing outrages on them. So Singhalese people believed that and they started to retaliate.
Did you, while you were at home for instance, through your family friends, did you also hear these rumors?
Oh yes.
Who do you think was spreading these rumors? Someone has to start it.
The rumors started from Kandy. Then they swept through the island. Mostly in the Singhalese provinces. Mm-hmm. That's what happened.
How is it that the British government came to feel that this attack on the Moors was an attack on their government?
That is, there were some Christians who were misleading the government. What happened was, there was the temperance movement was at its very, very height at the time, and Buddhist leaders were in the forefront. So, some mischief makers, the leading men of the country, told the governor that this is not a temperance movement, that's a movement to topple the government at a time when it is at war with Germany. So he believed it.
Have you any idea who these people were?
Well, I don't think it's advisable to mention names.
I'll knock this off.
One was Hector Mancunian.
Yes.
Another was Bandaranaike. Sir Solomon Dias Bandaranaike.
Yes, of course. Yes. What about Obisekara? Christopher?
Christopher, yes. He was also among those who misled the government.
I ask this because I saw something written by Dr. W. A. De Silva later on.
Yes.
And he mentions one Kuylenberg.
Yes.
But he also mentions two other names. I do not know if they were Christians, but they were municipal councillors. E. W. Jayawardena. And J.A. Pereira.
J.A. Pereira may be one, but E.W. Jayawardena was a bit of a petty. I don't think he would have misled the government.
I'm not sure if it's E.W. Is E.W. Jayawardena the same as Emmanuel Jayawardena?
No.
It's Emmanuel Jayawardena.
That's quite possible.
That's quite possible.
Multiple councillors. Yes.
Sorry, I made a mistake. Mm-hmm. I thought it was the same person.
Yes.
And I have seen a document which shows that Emmanuel Jayawardena went with John Fraser. To the railway sheds to try and quiet the workers there.
Yes, that is true. He tried that, but John Fraser also dealt very harshly with the Singhalese. He was a government agent at the time. Uh-huh. He didn't show the slightest sympathy towards the Singhalese people who were arrested and who were undergoing a lot of suffering in the jails. All the leaders, men like John Taylor, the greatest dramatist that Ceylon produced in recent times.
John Silva?
John Silva.
Both were put into jail?
Both were put into jail.
Did you feel that at times the British were vindictive, they tried to rub it in?
Yes.
Can you remember what exactly they did of this nature?
Because they did not give any attention to the protests that were being made. Mm-hmm. Avanti Sous, editor of the Morning Leader, was attacking the government for the great atrocities that the military men were committing, one innocent people. But he is a lone voice, but Ayo is a very powerful writer.
And
he did a lot for the Sinhalese. Avanti Sous, the editor of the Morning Leader, was a very powerful writer. And after Marshall was withdrawn, he wrote a letter, he wrote a book.
100 days
in Ceylon.
I got it.
Yes.
What sort of chap was Stubbs?
Stubbs was a... He had no determination of his own. He was also misled.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And he didn't sympathize with the Sinhalese people.
Denham,
of course, is a very... man with a more liberal outlook. And when there was a great debate took place in the legislative council after martial law, while martial law was in progress, then Mr. Ramanathan made a speech for five or six hours, and Stubbs had to reply as the colonial secretary. He was not mature, so Honorable Ramanathan. So Santan Burton, the attorney general, replied. He was a brilliant speaker himself.
What sort of man was Bertram?
Well, I was working on him. He's a very kind-hearted man and a very brilliant speaker. He's one of the greatest scholars that came out of Ceylon. And although a lot of people were under the impression that he was endorsing the activities of the military people, he did his level best to withstand that.
Did you feel that he was a weak type? He was not able to impose his views and his authority on the governor and others?
No, he may have tried his best, but the governor himself was helpless. And the officer commanding the troop was in sole charge of these activities.
During the height of the troubles, do you think the situation was quite serious?
When
the Moors were being attacked.
Oh yes, quite serious. And people, the police merely watched. They did not take any suitable action. Otherwise, the riots could have been suppressed in a day or two. This went on for about a week.
Were you present at the court, at Pendlesa's court martial?
No.
Gunasinghe relates a story of how when they were exercising in the yard, that is, those who were imprisoned, the chair on which Pedro sat when he was shot, the bloodstained chair was brought out and placed near them.
That is true. I heard it from one of the, from Mr. Kedar, and himself was in jail at the time. And the story is that they wanted to blindfold him and he refused. So to be blindfolded.
Of course, his case is a bit difficult to judge because there was evidence brought by a police constable too, which helped to convict him.
Yes.
So I was wondering whether it was concocted evidence or...
It may have been concocted because he himself admitted that he fired a shot to keep the crowd away from his shop.
But wasn't he one of these a fairly forward young man and a bit tough?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So I was wondering whether is there just a possibility that he also got worked up and...
No. A large crowd was seen opposite their shop at Main Street and he thought that they might attack the shop. So a shot was fired into the crowd. But I don't think anybody died as a result of that shot being fired.
He must have fired it above the head.
Yeah, he fired from the top floor.
Oh, he fired from the top floor?
Yes.
What about the money which the British government forced from the...
Right, compensation?
Yes.
Well, large sums are paid to Moors and Muslims whose shops and boutiques had been attacked. Of course, they were all inflated claims. A man who had suffered in Basel about 1,000 rupees submitted a claim for 10,000 and it was steadily paid. And all this money was collected from the taxpayers innocent as well as the guilty.
What did you feel about the way they collected the money from the Sinhalese villagers and from the respectable people?
I thought it was very unjust.
Did you feel that in some cases it was almost blackmail?
Yes. Almost blackmail.
They said, if you don't pay, we'll charge you.
Yes. Or we'll confiscate your properties. So they had to pay.
Among the British civil servants, did you feel that there were others like Bertram who were more sympathetic and who tried to quiet the
agreement? What's one of them? Freeman.
But it is correct then to say that the British authorities felt that this was not a blow merely at the Moors, but it was something against the government.
Against the government. That was what they felt. That is the wrong idea. But later on, when a big public meeting was held at the town hall, Sir James Pierce decided, and they moved a resolution calling for the appointment of a royal commission to inquire into the misdeeds of the British in the riots. Then Dr. Salman Panandu made a very powerful speech, and immediately after making a speech, he fell dead on the platform. That was what led to the agitation for the introduction of reforms.
I have no doubt that one reason why the British got this idea was this whispering campaign of people like Van Quillenberg. But I have also seen some documents at that time sent by AGAs and GAs. I don't know how far this is correct, but I can remember Cumberland maintaining that in some spot he named it, there had been a plan to meet at a certain junction, you know, for the groups to gather at a junction when certain temple bills and other things were run. And he was arguing from this that there was some local planning there.
Planning. There was no such planning. It was always almost a sudden flare-up. Temple bells were rung because now even at Pandura, there was a strong rumor that the Moors were coming to break down the most important temple there. Then the bells were rung and people collected. Because when a temple bell is rung, they know that there is some trouble. So they collected. Not with the idea of attacking the Moors, but to save the temple.
You were in Panadura then?
Yes, yes.
This sort of thing happened in 1958 too, those sort of rumors and fears?
Yes, yes, that is it, communal riots.
Yes. Because there were fears about what was happening to the Sinhalese in Vatican. In Colombo itself, did you feel that some of the leading rioters were workmen from the mercantile firms and from the railway workshops?
No, people from different classes of society. Mostly these working classes. So far, no respectable person had anything to do with the riots. But all the common people, they were fired by that fancy of religious feeling.
What about economic hostility? Didn't they dislike these boutique keepers?
That is also one of the things that came into play. Because in every nook and corner in the island, there was a postman running a prosperous shop, and the single man was pushed back.
Well, that's very interesting. If I may leave that subject and get on to another, did you serve as a headman at any time?
No. I joined the government service as a stenographer in 1915. I was appointed to the Supreme Court also as a stenographer. I came over from the intelligence department. Then a few years later I began to act as interpreter. Then I was appointed an interpreter and I retired as the chief interpreter of the Supreme Court after serving for a period of 35 years.
I'm very interested in the way in which the British civil service
worked in those days, particularly say in the outstations in a rural area, and even in Colombo, how would you assess the British civil service?
The civil service, of course, they are very highly intelligent and educated lot, and I think personally that they are very efficient. They have been stationed in the country. Of course, they depended mostly on subordinates like Kurlamudiyas, Porales, Hidman, and others. There were no revenue officers during that time. So, but I think they did a very efficient job, those officers of those times.
What was the attitude to the people?
Of course, they didn't move with the common man. But however, justice was done. They were courteous. When inquiry was held, they were always courteous. And that is why I replied without any unnecessary delay. But they didn't move with the common people.
I was wondering whether they were always impartial. If take a case between an European and a civilian, not necessarily a judicial case, even either a judicial case in a court of law, or something like a boundary dispute which GA had to settle, were they fair then?
If the civil servant happened to be European, he was not impartial.
He tended to favour the European?
Favour the European.
Especially in planting area?
In planting area.
Even in courts of law?
No. Courts of law, there's strict impartiality.
Would it be correct to say that the attitude of the average AGA to the villager was a paternal type of attitude?
Yes. How is it?
But there must have been some sort of gap because he had so much power.
Yes.
Sort of the villager must have looked on him as a sort of god.
Yes. But how he was accessible to the villager.
Oh, was he?
Oh, yes, he was accessible to the villager. He always gave the village fair hearing.
But wasn't it often through interpreters or through the Korale?
Either the Kachari Mudde or the Korale or the Mudde.
How many of them, how many of the British civil servants knew Sinhalese?
Very few.
And did those few know it well or just a little?
Oh, very well.
Who among the civil servants can you remember as knowing Sinhalese?
Oddington was one. And
Cumberland?
Cumberland.
Brain?
Brain also knew Sinhalese. So they knew the language. They mastered the language.
But don't you think that having this having these Korales, Ratamahatmayas, Mohandirams and others, especially at the district level, meant that there was some sort of barrier between the officers and the people?
No, I don't think so. Because they worked the quality better.
But didn't they have to rely a lot on these Korales?
They had to.
So I was wondering whether the bad type of Korale would use this to his own advantage or to his family.
There was a possibility, but you can't make it as a general complaint. That's a possibility of that.
You see, unlike, say, a Sinhalese GA or AGA, the British AGA and GA might not have known the family connections and the local situation. Therefore, he could be more easily fooled.
Yes, but most of the GAs knew all about the important people of the country, of the district in which they administered their functions. They always kept themselves well informed.
Oh, they knew who was a relative of whom?
Oh, yes.
Caste factors and all that?
They knew everything.
Of course, there's one important thing, isn't it? They went on circuits.
Circuit, yes. They went on regular circuits.
Today you get the jeep and the car and they go go from here to there.
Yes.
So I wonder whether they have as good a knowledge as some of the old GAs?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
Old GAs that got horseback or on foot, foot difficult terrain, and spoke to villages and made themselves, acquainted themselves with the real state of the affairs in the rural area. But these people go in a jeep and hold the quarry until a blue moon.
What about the land settlement department? What sort of department was it, and how good were its officers?
Land settlement, there's a lot of complaint against the land settlement department those days, because villages, lands belong to villages, had been alienated under the wastelands ordinance. And they found it very difficult to get back the land which had been taken over by the government. But land settlement department also, the officers depended mostly on the on their mudaliars. So he had a great influence.
No, I was wondering whether you can recall any cases in the Panadura district, your home area, of villages or even of well-known families who lost some land because of the work of the land settlement department.
Land settlement department, mostly it is in agricultural areas that the lands were taken over, upcountry. The low country, of course, down south, Madhura district and other places, some lands might have been taken over. But I have not much experience of that.
Among the British civil servants, who struck you as being real personalities and unorthodox people with imagination and...
Well, there was Coddington, of course, very impressive man, and Freeman, and a few others.
Newnham, what's the...
Newnham.
What's the chap? Was he?
He was a good man. He was a mayor of Colombo also at one time.
Reed?
Reed was a very good, very efficient and good administrator.
Any others who you felt were rather the lazy types who didn't care much about their job and were very mediocre?
I forget their names, there are a number of them.
Among the attorney generals, after Bertram, who did you come into contact with?
After Bertram, there was Mr. Gollan. And then there was Elphinstone. After that, Drayton, legal secretary.
Gollan and Elphinstone, what sort of chaps were they?
Oh, you can't say anything against Gollan and Elphinstone. Elphinstone came from a very high family in England.
Did you feel that he was a bit unreliable, Elphinstone? That he tended to say yes to this side and yes to the opposite?
Yes, that is, you are right.
Was Fletcher also like that?
Fletcher, the secretary. Fletcher was not a strong man. Chief Clifford is one of our great colonial secretaries, but he is not a sympathetic administrator.
Authoritarian?
Authoritarian.
Thompson and Graham Thompson.
Of course, there was nothing extraordinary about them.
Clement?
Chief Clementi, great man.
So, what are your own views about the headman system?
Personally, I think the headman system is superior to the present state of local administration. Because there, the headman came from a, always he was from an influential family. The most influential man in the village was may not have been a very educated man, but people, he commanded a lot of respect among the villagers.
But isn't it possible sometimes for you to get a really foolish type of man. So maybe his son becomes a headman.
Yes, there was a possibility. That is so. And that is why it was replaced, I think, mostly. Because it went from father to son. The son was may not have been so efficient and good as the father.
And speaking generally, would it be possible to say that the headmanships were reserved among a few families in Ceylon?
Yes, that is true. That is true. Uh-huh.
Were the British careful to take caste factors into account when appointing village headmen?
Yes. They very particular about it.
I suppose the people wanted this.
People wanted it.
What about corruption and family cliquism and favoration, which some people complain about?
That did not prevail to a large extent at that time. There were some cases, but that didn't prevail to such a large extent.
Referring to the 1915 riots, among the people charged, if it is noticeable that a good proportion were minor headmen or VC chairmen or registrars or, you know,
yes,
officials of the middle level. Is that correct?
Always some of the most influential men in the village were arrested. And then they were convicted on the evidence on the perjured testimony of Muslims and Muslims.
Uh-huh.
That is what happened.
Of course, it's possible that these people, being influential, had been members of the temperance societies quite legitimately, and because of that, they may have been arrested.
That is possible.
In fact, that's a very interesting movement, the temperance movement.
Yes, sir.
Can you tell me something about it? How popular it was? How?
No, it was. I think the temperance movement started in about 1912 or so, 1913, and then meetings were held all over the island. Largely attended. I myself attended a number of meetings. And
who organized the thing?
They are the society called the Total Abstinence Society. The secretary of which was one Mr. Abru. And all these leaders, C.A.Y. Tharun, D.P. Jayatilaka, Kedar Sirisen, John Silva, they were all taking active part. And people, a large number of taverns were closed as a result of this. The government introduced local option as a result of this temperance campaign. And hundreds of villages throughout the island, hundreds of taverns throughout the island were closed. So government later stage thought that this is not exactly a temperance movement. It's a movement calculated to bring down the government when Great Britain is at war with Germany.
Mm-hmm.
That of course they made amends for it. Later on they found that there was no truth in that suggestion.
No, I was not thinking of the 1915 riots. I was interested in the movement as a movement. Now, this Mr. Abru, for instance, is it a Diabru?
A Diabru.
Mm-hmm. From?
He was a businessman in Colombo.
What Diabru? You're not certain about his initials?
And W.H.W. Petra was one of the secretaries, W.H.W. Petra Proctor. He was one of the secretaries of the Total Abstinence Society.
That's E.W. Pereira's brother?
No, he's not related to the W. Petra.
The meetings you attended, who were the speakers?
There were some meetings were addressed by Ramanathan, Pandamadam Ramanathan, Amandi Souza, and Piyada Sirisena, Akbar Sena Nayak, D.S. Sena Nayak.
D.S. at that time?
Oh, yes, he came to the platform, became a platform speaker after attending these meetings and taking part in the activities.
He spoke in English then?
English. Mm-hmm. English.
Were these meetings in Colombo or in Panagura?
Mostly in Colombo.
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere at Miricama, another place.
You went to Miricama?
Yes, yes.
So, is it correct then to say that they were not only held in the towns, but they had meetings and also activities in the rural areas?
Yes. Oh, yes. In places like Bendigama, Gaul, Kegol.
Even in the Kenyan provinces?
Even in the Kenyan provinces.
But it doesn't seem to have gone very far north. Did it go to Anuradhapura and that area?
No, not too far.
I was wondering whether you found some bootleggers also supporting the movement like they did in America.
I don't think that happened in Ceylon.
Because, for instance, in 1965, when N.M. Pereira brought this study tax business, I think some of them are supposed to have got on a platform and criticized it, some of these coffee
poking.
So I was wondering whether that happened. No,
that didn't happen in Uruguay.
Was the movement then fairly well organized?
Oh yes, very well organized.
I mean, did the branches correspond with the center and...
Yes. One of the greatest temperance workers was Mr. Arthur Dias of Panagur. And he spent a lot of money out of his pocket. And Affairs Hiranaik also helped financially. It was a very well organized institution.
Arthur Dias, sir's participation is a bit ironical because his father was a...
Yes, center.
Renter.
Yes, it is
true. In fact, I have heard a funny version of the temperance movement. Some people say that, while there were many genuine workers, people who genuinely believed in abstinence and temperance or even in prohibition, some say that the Senanayakas in particular and some of the others felt that while this was good for Ceylon and getting rid of Western habits and so on and so forth, it would also help to reduce the position of the Karavas.
They have to talk to that effect. But I don't think they had such an ulterior motive.
No, and it's difficult to reconcile with W. A. De Silva's participation, Arthur Dias's.
Yes, but the Arthur Dias must have felt that the father's action in earning money was not justified. So he's not responsible for what his father did. So he thought the best thing is to use the money that the father has spent to put down the bring down the number of taverns in the country.
Would you say that one of the motives prompting people to take part in temperance was the feeling that it was not Buddhistic, that it was not traditional, and that this is something brought from outside?
Quite so.
To what extent did the villager, say in the Panadura area, in Mirigama, in Purana, and such places, actively feel that he was part of the temperance movement?
Because he felt that this was against his religion. That it was affecting him economically. That is, family is undergoing great misery and hardship. And particularly it is against the rest of our religion. So he welcomed the idea.
So you think the villager was drawn into this movement?
Drawn into this movement.
I was wondering whether it was only limited to the middle class. The
villager was drawn into this movement. We should have seen the huge attendance. Now thousands of people attended this temperance meeting in various parts. Colombo and outlying areas.
What sort of man was Walasinghe Harishchandra?
He was a religious worker. He fought for the preservation of the city of Anuradhapura and the restoration of the ancient sites. In fact, he wrote a number of books. One of the important books was Pura Vidya. And he was the disciple of Anagarika Dhanapala.
Did you come into contact with Dhanapala at all?
Well, I can relate an interesting incident. I had just left St. Thomas College when he started a newspaper called the Young Ceylon or something. Then I contributed an article for the first issue. So the issue was out on a Friday evening.
What year was this?
That was in 1913 or 14. So I went to buy a copy of the paper. Then the paper had just come out of the press and he was having a look at it in the veranda of the office. Then I said, I want to buy a copy of this paper. Then he gave me the paper which he held in his hand, and asked me for 10 cents. Price of the paper was 10 cents. I gave him the 10 cents, I looked at the paper to find my article published on the front page. Then I said, this article is written by me. So he took me, he practically embraced me, took me to his office, asked me to sit down, and he wanted me to join the paper as a journalist. And he wrote his love. That was the first time I came in contact with him. I always made it a point to listen to his speeches.
Yes, in what way did he speak?
He was a very fiery speaker. His language is sometimes violent, but he used to denounce the Britishers. Yes.
Did you feel that he was a bit fanatical too in some ways? Did he go beyond the point and attack the Muslims sometimes?
No, he didn't. Uh-huh. He didn't. But he was a powerful speaker.
Spoke in Sinhalese, I suppose.
Sinhalese.
Mm-hmm. Never in English.
Well, I haven't heard him speaking in English, but he conducted a journal in English, Mahabodhi journal,
mm-hmm.
to which he contributed largely.
Earlier he conducted the Buddhist talks in English.
Yes, Buddhist talks. Then he started the Sinhala Bahudya.
How important was he and Mr. Valisingh Harishchandra in the temperance movement?
Valisingh Harishchandra also took a great deal of interest in the temperance movement.
Mm-hmm.
So did Dhanagara Dhanrapala. But it was very seldom that Anagarika Dhanrapala attended these meetings because he was mostly in India at the time. That is what happened.
Did you find any women participating in the temperance?
Not at that time. Then we had no women speakers. One or two may have attended a few meetings, but not.
You see, I asked that question because I heard the story of one individual who said he was brought into contact with Dharmapala.
Mm.
This may not have been temperance. He was brought into contact with Dharmapala because one of his followers, a lady, came to the village wearing a sari.
Mm.
And so I was wondering how many such women workers there were.
No, there weren't any women workers, but large numbers of women used to attend the temperance meeting.
Now in those days, what form of dress did the Sinhalese women wear? Was the sari very popular?
Very popular. And for that also Anagarika Dhanrapala was responsible. He even right. introduced the sari.
Oh, before that what happened?
Before that for the frock and jacket.
Or cloth and jacket.
Cloth and jacket.
Or frock.
Or frock.
Would it be correct to say that Dhanrapala was attacking these westernized habits and these Western values, and he wanted something Ceylonese and traditional and national and Buddhistic?
Yes.
But in many ways, didn't he himself have certain Western habits of thought and a certain amount of individualism? To some degree, wasn't he a bit Westernized?
Yes, that so far as he suited his purposes, his idea was to bring about a national regeneration. So he took what is good from the rest and discarded what is bad.
I was wondering whether some of our political leaders like D.B. Jatuk and Senanayakas went into this temperance movement partly through conviction but also because they felt this was one way to awaken the masses, to get the villager to take an interest in the national movement in politics?
Yes. Oh yes. That's quite right.
How? What makes you say that? Did you speak to them about it or was it generally known?
It is generally known. Because they wanted to bring before the village, rural masses the idea of self-government and independence. So through the temperance movement they were put those ideas into execution.
So, in your time, you yourself were aware of this intention?
Yes.
But what is remarkable is that they did not really continue on these lines. They went into the constitutional demands and things, and you see, after about 1920,
yes.
the vigor of temperance activity seems to have declined.
That happened. Because they were then going in a different direction, agitating for constitutional reforms.
leaving that aside and coming to 1931 and 1936, were you, for instance, in favor of the grant of universal franchise at
yes.
that stage?
Oh, yes. Well,
not many people were keen on universal franchise
no.
at that stage.
Ramanathan was a vigorous opponent.
Oh.
The opponent of Ramanathan. But A. Gun Singh was one of the people who supported the idea.
Yes. Would it be correct to say that he was very, very unpopular among the British civil servants at that stage?
Yes. Very unpopular.